Are there any questions or anything someone wants to say? Plus.
In your last talk, you mentioned in the second half that everybody has a kind of insecurity. And my first question is easy. Did I really get it right that really everybody? And you didn't talk about why this is. Is this something that all parents are not loving enough or are able to give an environment which gives the security to a child when it grows? Or is it something which is in the condition like we are as humans, and even if best love from parents and environment is with a cure?
Could you hear? So he's saying, in my last talk I mentioned briefly that we're all deeply insecure, and he's first saying, did I hear you right? And so yes, until it's resolved, the deep insecurity is very much present and moving us. And then he's asking why. So one response to why is the Gautam Buddha response, which is, if we're struck by an arrow, first take the arrow out and then bother about where it comes from and what it's made of. And so that's one answer, is who cares why? But can we resolve it? Can it be resolved? And the same guy said, yes, it can be resolved. It does seem like having good conditions helps. So he said, is it that if parents could be really good parents, maybe we wouldn't have that deep insecurity? So I think it does help when there's love, especially the earlier the better, like being surrounded in love. And so many other things that are involved in parenting. But love in its many modes helps. But I think there is this kind of paradox that we can resolve, that we can find a way to live with. So let me speak about that paradox a little bit. But even with really good conditions, even with parents that gave us all the confidence they could, protection, support, freedom, touch, food, shelter, etc., communication, response, receiving us. I spoke in the instructions a few days ago, in the morning time, the 10:15 time, about noticing the watching ourselves thing that the mind does. So the mind breaks into two pieces and watches me. And it often watches me pretending that I know what you think of me, and I track that to know where I am and how I am by what I think you think of me, or what I think of you. And to kind of really get that is something that's functioning within my own mind, apart from what other people are thinking and judging, and to really get. So when we're here quietly with our eyes closed, lying down, sitting, mostly, as far as I can tell, people aren't looking at you and saying how many thoughts you have and how your thoughts are disturbing me, or what a near Buddha you are, or any of that. And so we can start to accept and find how there's that nearly invisible layer that keeps coming over. So there's a song of Kabir where he says, within the heart a mirror, but no face shows. The face will show when the heart's doubleness goes. And I actually think I have it here. Hridaya bhitar arsi. Hridaya is heart. So not hard in the sense of, in the last retreat we talked about man, like mind, heart, thinking and emotion, but another kind of heart. So a more heart-like heart, a deeper heart. In that heart, in the deep heart, inside it, bhitar, arsi, there's the possibility of seeing. Mukh dekha nahi jai. The face will not be seen. The face is not going to be seen. Mukto tabhi dekhi ho jab dil duvidha jai. When the heart's doubleness, duvidha, the two-ness of the heart, goes, the face will show by itself. So simply uncovering that face, that friend, in the deep heart, simply by not believing that layer that comes and watches me and judges me. So we're lonely and we think that we're out and we don't belong. And I hear this from so many people in so many different contexts and ways. So last time I called it deep insecurity. Today, the flavor of what I'm hearing from people all around is feeling alone or feeling out. And so it's another way of saying the same thing that I meant the other day with the deep insecurity. We couldn't ever be out, but we experience deeply as if we're out. And it can be resolved. So partly by not looking for a reflection. So we want to get a sense of ourselves as if from outside to know how we're doing. And so when the heart's doubleness goes, we're inside our heart. We're not checking out in the mirror. And then the heart's face shows, and we're inside it. It comes from a lot of practice with others. Like we hear people say, oh, you look great, or are you okay, or I really don't like your, we get it, we practice together, but it happens inside us. It's like this thing that keeps happening in the mind all the time. And so one thing is if we realize that we're all doing that, torture to ourselves, tortura. And to others, secondarily, yes. But we need to address that jumping out of our skin directly, and we can.
Jumping out of our skin.
How am I doing? Can I see the friend? Is that the friend? Did I catch a glimpse of the friend? So last time there was the poem where the marvelous does happen, but not to expect to return to it. We stay open that the marvelous keeps coming. And the marvelous doesn't mean only the good. Marvel is just something like miracle, unexpected, unusual. So from aloneness, we try to find a friend. We try to catch the glimpse of the friend. And the resolution is coming from being inside the friend. And we do need friends whom we can rely on. And I said this in the last retreat, and I feel it again so much today. Even in just the very fact of this Kabir poem that I have here, that was translated by a friend of mine named Linda Hess and her friend Sukadev Singh, that she gave me the book like 11 years ago, and I copied out my favorite ones, the English translation. And then she, on my notes, in her own hand, in Hindi, because I asked her, wrote the Hindi for me, because it's not in her book. And I have that paper 11 years later. At midnight before leaving Spain, I scanned it so I could have it in the computer and not have to carry all the papers. But it's her handwriting next to my handwriting on a paper that's 11 years old, a poem that's, you know, hundreds of years old. Just feeling the outer friendship, the quality of it, that can help us sink back into the friend that's inside, bhitar, hridaya bhitar. And so partly it's like owning our deep eyes. So instead of we see something shining, we want to get a reflection. We see something shining, we let ourselves be drawn into it and look from there. And it's different eyes that we look with, as I said a couple days ago in the talk also. At first, it's blind eyes that we look with from down here. We don't actually see where we're going. And we can't read the signs. So there's a poet that I was introduced to about 8 years ago. Someone wrote me out by hand this really long piece that's wonderful about rest and restlessness, which I've lost. And she misspelled the name of the poet. So I was Googling the name every once in a while over the years. I've got to find that guy, Lunig. And finally, it was ripe last year when I was in India first. I heard an Australian person from Melbourne mention this poet named Lunig. And then I was in Melbourne, where this poet Lunig is from. He was actually giving a presentation with a woman named Jaya while I was there. And he's just wonderful. So he's been this friend I've been searching for all these years, and then turned out he was from the hometown of a lot of my close friends all along, freely available on internet. And he was a newspaper political cartoonist until he just couldn't take that anymore. And so he started doing crazy cartoons, and the newspaper liked it. And so these really bizarre spiritual cartoons were going out in the Melbourne newspaper every day. And here's one of them. It's from a book of his called A Common Prayer. So it's usually a spiritual rather than religious. In this case, he's using the word God. God, give us rain when we expect sun. Give us music when we expect trouble. Give us tears when we expect breakfast. Give us dreams when we expect a storm. Give us a stray dog when we expect congratulations. God, play with us, turn us sideways and around. Amen. So somewhere deep in us, we're looking for that kind of friend. So not just the friend that when we expect congratulations says, oh, you're great. And also not that kind of friend who always has the like hard, honest approach. We expect a storm and we receive dreams. The deep insecurity keeps coming in because somewhere we wish we could count on it in the way we think we're supposed to, this friendship. That what I expect as a sign of love should come, and then I know it's love. So there's the deep insecurity, and there's also this deep place that wants to play and wants something bigger than us to play with us. To turn us upside down and shake out our pockets. So that we don't miss the real deep friendship. So there's another Kabir song that I love. And in this case, Linda, my friend Linda, who translated it with Sukhdev, just there was not English words available. So we're gonna, I'll read her translation, I'll read the Hindi, and we'll start to try to feel what she means and what Kabir meant. So Kabir was a poor guy who was a weaver, poor in the sense of not having much money and not being bothered about having much money. And he just kept doing his thing, his family life, his weaving, and he would sing. And he would give rain when we expected sun. Pani te ati patala, much thinner than water. Dhuan te ati bhin, subtler than smoke. Pawanahu te utabla, swifter than wind. Dost Kabira king, Kabir's friend. So pani te ati patala. Patala, now in Hindi, patala is thin, like if you thin the soup or you thin the milk, you add water and it gets more liquidy. Pani se patala, thinner than water, but pani te ati patala. It's not just much thinner than water. It's like the way that water makes milk thinner or makes soup thinner gives some kind of vague, faint sense of ati patala, like what would be a quantum leap of more liquidic. So I want to give a sense of this word ati that some of you might relate to, some of you might not. On this side of this mountain, there's a little village that's still little, and it's called Adi Anamalai. It's like the original Anamalai, like the original village of this mountain. It's still just a small village despite all the sprawl that's happened in other parts of around the mountain. And I'm an artist, so when I first went into that town and then I went into that temple, and I felt the temple doesn't feel very alive, but I was very drawn to the columns of the temple and the carvings on the columns. And every single column is carved differently, and there are dozens or maybe even hundreds of them. And maybe from age or maybe from the care that went into the carving, it's these really subtle, beautiful carvings that are more graceful than what you usually come across. So it might be from age and being worn, or it might be that they were just done that way at the time and they've lasted. It just gives this sense of there was something going on here long ago. Thousands of years ago in this place that's now dark and kind of wet, and there's like bats in the corner and bat shit on the ground. The tenderness in the stone of these columns and the care in finding the symbol of each face of each column. It just gives this kind of subtle sense of beauty or grace just for its own sake and with a kind of meaning. Not for no reason, but also inexplicable that that could happen. We couldn't pay anyone to do that. So when I mentioned how I loved the temple, even though it's not a very live temple, to a few people that live around here, they said, you know, there's a legend that from that temple, that British, when they came here, and they like to dig up and find the different layers of culture that have happened in different places. So the British Archaeological Survey, now the Indian Archaeological Survey, dug down supposedly and found that there was a passageway that had been dug underground from the temple to the center of the mountain. So I'm not saying it's true, I'm saying it's a legend, I don't know. And then not surprisingly, the legend has another even more mythical part to it that says that the passageway led to the center of that mountain that's considered to be God by many, like hundreds of thousands of people. Inside the mountain, hundreds of people chanting. People who have done long life practices who are chanting inside the mountain. That's the myth that goes with the legend. That we could just trace from these graceful, subtle carvings. So for me, whether to believe or not doesn't really come up. And I'm not trying to get you to believe something also at all, please don't. But one time I met a really beautiful old guy who had lived on this mountain and lived with Ramana Maharshi named Anamalai Swami. The same word as the Anamalai village, Anamalai. It's the name of that mountain also. And he was, you know, wearing the typical white thing that looks like a diaper that people used to wear here, so hot, just the white cloth, loincloth. I met him, he died within a year when I met him. He was very old and frail. And I just said, people talk about the grace of the mountain, and what is that? And at first I thought he wasn't answering my question. I thought he was just, didn't maybe understand. But basically I realized what he said to me and in answer to my question, what is this thing that people talk about, the grace of this mountain? He said, people have come here for thousands of years to meditate, to do what needs to be done. That's why these things happen that are called grace. So he actually gave a very unmythical, un-legend-like response. So the power of doing what needs to be done. The importance of having a sense of what is it that needs to be done and letting that happen. It comes from closeness to the friend or a sense of friendship. Of not buying into the feeling outside, feeling not belonging, feeling alone. So that means sometimes we really need encouragement from another person. It doesn't mean, therefore, we should never depend on each other or ask for help or ask for a sign of friendship to help us remember friendship. Whatever helps us feel that possibility in our very world that seems so unfriendly, the possibility of tuning into friendliness. So not the expectation that people treat me in a friendly way, but tuning into the possible friendliness, the potential friendliness. Whatever helps us do that. Helps us know what needs to be done and what needs not to be done. If we give each other the encouragement that we need and the receiving of each other that we need, and we don't do too much also of just exchanging signs of friendship, but staying with friend. So Kabir's friend, Panite Ati Patala, something quantumly thinner, more like liquid than even water. So not only water as a metaphor for how ungraspable this beloved is, not only much more liquid than water, but water as just a poor metaphor for how fluid this deep friendship is, or what lives inside the deep heart is. Kabir's friend is that one who is quantumly more subtle than smoke. Dhuante atib bhin. Bhavanahute utavla. That much quantumly faster than even wind. That's who Kabir's friend is. Dost Kabirakin. Another way to speak and listen about this is as we feel more chance to rest comfortably in the deep heart and not give as much energy to the conversation about how I'm doing or what they think and what I think, the judge and the critic and the not belonging. As we learn how to practice that, whatever helps that, we will feel something just like Kabir did. I want to say does. That we can't catch, but we can feel. That's fluid is just a poor metaphor for that fluidity. Smoke is just a poor metaphor for that subtlety. And wind is just a poor metaphor for that quickness. So when we're resting softly with what we already have, Kabir often uses the word sahaj, which can be translated as simple or easy or ease. But the word sahaj, where it comes from, is born with. It's what we're born with, sahaj. Sahaj, actually. And it has also a quality of like our relatives that we're friendly and at home with, and there's a bond that's unbreakable, we can't escape. As we rest into that softness with power that we can't catch and we can't rely on in the way we thought we should, the possibility of the friendly world as a possibility, keeps coming up. And I also think that about probably a random number, 90% of our needs for psychotherapy would be taken care of. Which means we'd have a lot more money to travel and do retreats and look at carvings and pet the cat or whatever. The subtlety with the quickness, the soft touch with the quickness, that something comes into our mind. And if we let our responsiveness be that quick, then we follow through. And friendship is realized for a moment. Even across cultures where someone from Japan wouldn't normally say anything about their emotions or someone from Germany wouldn't think that they're being too direct or whatever. That even across cultures, even things that we can't keep in our mind to navigate through, more subtle than all of that complication. The smoke, more subtle than smoke, can just pass through walls that seemed impassable. So I want to just give a few qualities of friendship that happen as we let our heart's doubleness go. And we feel the fluidity, subtlety, and swiftness, quickness of Kabir's friend inside. So I mentioned one a little bit already that I would now call like the shameless friendship. That we can stay tuned in to the possibility of a friendly world and feel what needs to be done and what doesn't need to be done and let that happen. Even in the face of an unfriendly gaze, even in the face of unfriendly company. Even in the face of people who don't care. So not needing everyone to be participating in the same way, to participate fully. There's something that I call the glass wall that I experienced most in my life, the first time, the most clearly, after the birth of my son, when things didn't go according to plan, to say the least. And so we were those parents in the intensive care with the little baby in the incubator, with the other parents who were with their babies in there. So there was, and the nurses were amazing. And so there was company. Inside the glass wall, doing what could be done and not doing what couldn't be done. And knowing that people who saw us in the hall and saw us going into the neonatal intensive care, the pity, and understanding how, of course, they would feel pity, because it would seem too hard to calculate how hard it must be to walk through those doors. But it wasn't, it was just what was happening. And it was hard, but it was what was happening. It was life, and that's all. I was surprised to find that the glass wall never went away in the experience of mothering. What I mean by the glass wall is there's no stopping. There's not a day off. There's always something that needs to be done or not done. And no one else could do it. The mother does it, for now. And it always seems to be just sort of above my head. So I'm not like swimming gracefully along in the waters of mothering. And I understand that it can't be understood. And that it would be easy to look as if through a glass wall at something happening in there that can't be reached. And still, one just does what needs to be done and doesn't do what doesn't need to be done to the best of our ability. And the sense of exposure, because as mothers with children, there's a sense, like at least in Spain and India, where I've been spending most of the time very publicly mothering. On the bus, if the child is asleep and the head is hanging, it won't be just one person who says, her neck, watch out. It's like, she likes to sleep that way, you know. It's okay. The head might be like this. And in the book it says, watch out for the infant's neck, but the infant only sleeps like this. So let her sleep. Someone on the bus feels concern, feels responsibility for the child as a fellow adult, but just continuing to do what needs to be done. Sometimes someone on the bus comes with a helpful suggestion or a toy that helps distract the bored child or whatever, even if most of the time it's unhelpful. People thinking they're being so helpful. Accepting the glass wall, so you're in your thing, you're doing what needs to be done. And you're not doing what doesn't need to be done as best you can. And people might come with their ideas of what would be helpful for you. And they're really busy being helpful. And so accepting that glass wall, but not thinking that subtler than smoke, swifter than wind, more fluid than water, has any problem with a glass wall. Yeah.
I'm not sure about the glass wall.
The glass wall is where there's full participation.
On your side.
Without a possibility of hesitation. Hesitation or holding back or pause or whatever. And then there could be a view, oh, how terrible, how difficult, from others, without a chance for understanding or participating together. There's a distancing through pity or through wanting to help.
Others meet the gospel, not you.
Well, there's a sense sometimes of the glass wall being there.
Yeah.
And the possibility of feeling through the glass wall, too. But accepting that one is being seen through a glass wall, as if, but not accepting that the glass wall is real. Accepting when someone needs to hold back or doesn't know how to get in. And so then, which means they're in the ideas. We're in the ideas. What I found in my glass wall experience was a sense of kinship with people in much more difficult situations, like refugees or etc. A sense of how often it would be easy to feel alone, because they're in such a situation that seems so terrible with no way out. But in the situation, even when there's despair, there's still a kind of place of aliveness, there's still a deep friendship that finds a way out through that subtler than smoke, faster than air, more fluid than water. So what it means is, no matter what situation we find ourselves in, there's a way through the sense of aloneness. And there's an invitation. So sometimes there's the glass wall also in a joyous experience, a sense of full participation in life for whatever reason. And there can be acceptance of the unfriendly or the overly helpful kind of interference, non-cooperation. And then the possibility of feeling this more subtle friendship that keeps the doors open. that's willing to feel that even more subtle than I've ever felt before. Ati Patala. Where I thought was a dead temple, where I thought was empty, where I thought was just a legend. It turns out that every gesture can make a difference, every gesture can count, and not a pressure that I must make every gesture count. But the sense of friendship where a friend honors your presence on the planet to such an extent that there's a knowing that any gesture you make as a human being has importance. So shameless friendship is even when we feel exposed, and even when it would be so easy to feel alone and cut off. Accepting that even in a situation that looks so terrible or so high that there's no communication with normal daily life, leaving the doors open and what leaves the doors open, is that even in the most terrible situations, in my experience so far, there's a possibility for this full participation that has a fulfillment in it. And so then we're not bothered about the situation and trying to navigate and control the situation. We're interested in the full participation. Just doing our best, so shamelessly. I grew up in the city of Atlanta in the United States, which is in the southeast. And during my early childhood was what's called in the United States the civil rights movement or civil rights struggle. And there was violence and courage and change. And Atlanta was the big city of the Southeast. So it was the headquarters of these movements. Movements towards more respectful laws for people of color, especially at that time, African American people. And there was a movement against that. So there were these movements going on. And the fact that the city that I grew up in went through that experience brought out a quality of caring and knowing that every word and every gesture makes a difference. And so it's important. It came into people's awareness more solidly, you can say, or more in a more real way, that it was important not to say the old joke, for example. And so I didn't know that people told racist jokes still until I left the racist Southeast. Because of the experience of going through the civil rights movement, there was a more general awareness of the importance of words and gestures of respect. When I went to Boston in the Northeast, I was shocked regularly to hear racist jokes from people who hadn't been through that experience. So there was a carelessness about word and gesture. It wasn't that the people were bad, they just hadn't been through that experience. So there wasn't a communal atmosphere of care. So there's shameless friendship where, despite exposure, doing what needs to be done, and through the fulfilling quality of doing what needs to be done. The doors are open for inviting others to participate fully in their own way. And through the experiences that come by doing what needs to be done and living our lives, care keeps coming in more and more fully. And we start to be more aware of the power of gesture and word and thought. Not in a top-down heavy way that's pressure about it, but it just starts to fill us. So I call it experiential friendship. When I went to college was also the first time I really had contact with a Catholic person. My roommate, Angela, was the 13th child, the youngest of a Portuguese family. And I'd grown up in the typical North American, or at least United States family, that was all about individuality, individualism. And so I kept being overwhelmed by how much she participated in her family, how much interaction and mutual support and demand went on. And at first, it seemed really foreign. And gradually, over decades, I start to get the feeling of the importance of being bothered, the importance of being open to demand. So not just looking for that relief that's important to feel inside us, where we don't take anyone's demand or expectation right into our core, but on our surface, we are open, that you might demand of me as my friend. You might need me. And I also might need you. And there's a freedom there. And that's another way that experience sets friendship in motion in the world and in our system, in our alignment with the deep beloved. In a really simple way. Yeah.
I understand the demands in friendship.
A little bit louder.
Oh, I understand the demanding in the friendship outwardly, but how do you can say this is inwardly also?
I'm saying it can be a really important spiritual, meditative, life experience to experience a place inside that's not moved by demand. That's important. And from there, we can be willing to listen to people's needs and our own needs, and to be of mutual support. Because the deep friend, the deep friendship, the deep beloved, the undividedness, the not aloneness is so deeply inside us already. As we uncover that friendship, we more easily move as friends in the outer, so-called outer world. When someone's demand has a power that we can't say no to because of the power of the demand, or because of our conditioning, whatever, the response won't be full, it won't be fulfilling. We know. It will be exhausting, and we will resent them. We know how it goes. So this is one of the main problems in our relationships, including the intimate ones that we can't seem quite to. I am counting the number of people I know who have what they consider to be fulfilling intimate relationships, and I have a full hand now. And I'm willing to go to the second hand if you want to tell me. So it's so simple in that way, but not easy. Until we get the hang of really accepting that that movement of judging me, criticizing me, putting me up, putting me down, that movement of separating is happening in my own structures. And then we start to be able to let it go again and again and again and again. And we start to experience and be fulfilled with the place of no demand. And then needs are simple things. So there's a way that's called karma yoga, the way of unity or union through action. And the whole point of it is that there could be action not wanting a certain result. So in other words, not from a place of demand, but still in action. Action, of course, as we've said already here, doesn't mean aerobics or whatever. There's the active rest, the creative rest, and the restful act. So the second part of the talk will be for another day, since we're already over. But I'd still like to just hear if there's any other question for today. Or any other thing to say. Yes, Leniji.
I was wondering, in dealing with the insecurity that we talked about in the first part of the talk, in ourselves and in others, that loving kindness meditation, can that be a helpful tool, not only in the basic loving kindness meditation, but in loving the thing that is in us that is not right, that is keeping me from loving in the way that I would be comfortable and would like to love?
Yeah. So for, I don't know if I should say most people, many people, finding a way to practice, so metta really means friendship, gentleness and friend. We call it loving kindness that's how it happened, that we call it loving kindness. The word means friend. So we find the ways that help us come into the softness and power of the real heart. And that is what is important. So one way is to find the words that help me resonate with uncovering that beloved that's here, the friendship that's here.
Are you talking about words or phrases?
The traditional way, may I be at ease, may I be free, or just peace, the word peace, letting it like a bell, to help our system remember that it's something that, just to uncover, or just to come home to, like, oh, I can let go of this division. I cannot believe that. Watching me and then feeling embarrassed, watching me and then feeling proud, watching me and then describing it. We can just start to. So one way is practicing formal loving kindness meditation, and I think that it's helpful for most people to find their way with that. For me, it was very helpful to do like that all day long for days and days. And there are so many other ways to practice loving kindness, to practice friend. And they will come to us if we kind of ask. And then if we follow through, even though it's silly or extreme or so simple and ordinary, or all the excuses we have for not letting the gesture happen. And then the gesture speaks to us and helps us settle into the inside of the heart. Like when I let it be, oh, is it possible not to get caught up in my insecurity and your insecurity, but that I do it just like that, almost like the Adiyanamalai temple, that it's not even really a living temple, but there's a trace left of that subtlety and aliveness that went into those carvings. So I can just barely feel that grace. From there, I feel like offering myself a flower, or what comes is I just take a drink of water, or whatever it may be that comes. And usually, we won't do it, because it would be embarrassing, because it's not in the books, because it wasn't mentioned in the instructions, because someone is watching us and they're doing it better, or I might wobble if I really slow down in my walking, I start to wobble and then I might fall down. So doing what needs to be done in that subtle sense, softness that comes and kind of presents something. At first it's like this, it presents something that we prevent, that we get in the way of. Gradually it gets more fluid, more fast, and we're not deciding whether to do it or not, we're just, it's happening. But for now, let there be a pause and an acceptance or a resistance, and we it's not to force ourselves through it. What does the friend say when we know it would be so good just to sit on the bench and forget about the walking meditation and enjoy the atmosphere of sunset? But we don't. Okay, the friend is still with us. So yes, loving kindness meditation, but don't stop there. And if you want to do loving kindness meditation 24 hours, please do. I think that for most of us, it's if we can find a way that suits us, it's, I think, the most helpful practice that we can do.
Well, and then you come into the thing of the unknown. I mean, practicing it, making a mistake, then all those things that you talked about, feeling foolish.
So we just know embarrassment is not my friend. Showing off is not my friend. The unknown is my friend. Something in me loves the unknown. It says, God, give us rain when we expect sun. Because I don't want to be spending my life expecting. And when the rain falls and I didn't expect it and I feel it on my skin, it's good. And that is that friend, that love, that one, that heart not being double and a face showing. Something shows up. So now it's getting long. Let's just close and just close eyes if you wish for a few moments. Feeling. Letting go. Maybe not thinking about so much. May our being here together and our willingness to do what needs to be done to the best of our ability participate without holding back in a momentum towards liberation for all.